afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. You can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about upcoming guests, features, events, and other shows on our network. If you have any questions or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please visit us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to questions@theorganicview.com. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking to Patricia Foreman, who is an amazing, amazing person. And she has authored several books, one of which we're going to be talking about today, which is called City Chicks. For those of you that have thought about raising chickens, it's something that is actually not that hard to do, but you really need to know what you're doing. And also you have to be considerate of the fact that in the area that you may live, it may not be prohibited. More and more people are actually raising chickens due to the inhumane practice of factory farms and also the use of antibiotics for folks that wish to grow food organically, locally, and sustainably. Raising chickens has been the most popular method to do the right things for the environment as well as for yourself. Now, across America, municipalities are allowing and even encouraging residents to keep laying hens within city limits. And in the book, City Chicks, Patricia Foreman gets into everything that you need to know as far as raising chickens, how to keep them safe, and also how to just really develop a relationship. And some people are discovering what's called a chicken whisperer, which Pat will get into a little bit later. I had the pleasure of meeting her at the Mother Earth News Festival, and she had the star of City Chicks, Ms. Oprah Henfrey. And let me tell you, what a beautiful, beautiful bird. So I would like to welcome to the show Pat Foreman. Good afternoon, Pat.
Yeah, hi, June. It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you so much for having me as a guest.
Thank you, Pat. How many books do you have out at this point?
Well, depends how you count them, June. I get, I would say five. We'll go with five.
Wow. And, you know, just watching you with Oprah Henfrey was, you could tell how much love you have for your chickens. It's not just some type of kooky hobby. It's something that you're very passionate about. And you could tell by the relationship between you and Oprah Henfrey, should I say, that, you know, you definitely have that special bond with her, and I think that's very important. And it's interesting, people don't respect chickens. They don't understand how smart they are and how caring they are. I mean, it's interesting, when I grew up on my parents' farm, we would see mother hens just care for other babies, and human beings won't even do that. It's amazing. Human beings, they won't take in another person's child, but yet with chickens, especially hens, they will care for another being's offspring and treat them and raise them as their own.
Well, they can. Sometimes they will just take a little baby chick under wing, so to speak, but there's also times when they'll reject them and be pretty mean to them. So they do have their... They do have their peculiarities, just like people in so many ways. Yeah, June, you were talking about Oprah Henfrey and how, she really was the star. I must admit, I was just her sidekick in so many ways because she's there. You know, so many people have never seen a live chicken before. It's been amazing to me that just about every place I go, much less been able to touch one and pet them, and to see that you don't have to. You know, they're not these brainless, squawking, flighty, you know, dirty beings it's just kind of the archetype that comes to people's minds. So she's really a poultry ambassador out there changing the archetype and the way people look and view chickens. So,
you know, it's interesting. I think part of that reason is because we are so completely disconnected with agriculture. I recently had Joel Saladin on the show, and he was talking about just not only the books that he's written, but just some of his own personal experiences and observations. And people are completely disconnected with agriculture. I mean, it's interesting when you talk to kids about chickens. Most of them have no idea that they have feathers. They have no idea what they sound like. They think that chicken is basically something that comes in the shape of a dinosaur, not even a real shape of a dinosaur, and breaded and ready to heat and serve.
They do. Chickens have descended from dinosaurs. In fact, there is a little bit of Tyrannosaurus Rex in your little feathery backyard friend. they're amazing creatures. They truly are.
Yeah, and it's a shame because they're really wonderful. I mean, they can be alarm clocks. They can be very affectionate. They're just great when it comes to helping you keep some of the little pests away from your tomatoes. Hopefully they won't nibble too much on your lettuce. They're just great to have in every yard. And personally, I think chicken manure is probably the best as far as fertilizer.
Well, it is. In fact, it's interesting that the chicken manure has an NPK, you know, nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus levels that rival commercial agriculture. And, of course, when it's in the right place and in the right amounts, it becomes such a valuable asset or organic asset to backyard agriculture. And that's one of the places where chickens shine. One of their skill sets is providing organic, non-toxic local agriculture. As well as you'd mentioned being pesticiders. I mean, chickens are voracious carnivores. And they'll go around and literally glean ticks and fleas off your yard, as well as grasshoppers and moths and even slugs. So they can substitute us for some of the pesticides that we've got. And there's quite a bit to learn about that. I mean, in some ways, we're still exploring how to employ chickens in local agricultural systems. But they're pretty handy.
Yes, exactly. And what I think is also nice is that, you're dealing with another being that is basically a natural fit for the environment, whereas all of these chemicals that we constantly keep dumping, it winds up back into our bodies. And people just don't get that. But it's interesting that so many people are taking classes, buying books, just asking for information about how they can raise chickens in their own backyards. And you know something, you don't need to have a big farm in order to do that.
No, not at all.
What are some of the trends that you've seen, Pat, as far as in the urban areas?
Well, June, what's wonderful is in the past 5 years alone, over 500 towns and cities have changed their laws to allow residents to keep chickens. I mean, the trend has not even started to crest yet. I know across, and that's across North America, not just only the U.S., but also Canada. And what's also interesting is in England, they're wondering, what's the big deal in America about chickens? They don't quite get why we don't all just have chickens in our backyards, those who want them. And the response to that is, well after World War II, June, Europe knew what it was to be pummeled and to have food shortages. So in truth, in most of the European countries, the chickens never left the backyards because they were so much of the local food supply during those war years, and it was so valuable. So in many ways, we're coming back round to a back-to-the-land movement that I think is even more significant than it was in the 60s, you know, with Helen and Scott Nearing. But this time, the back-to-the-land movement is to people's backyards. And that's what's so exciting, because we're discovering that it really can grow a lot, I mean a lot, of produce and food on small plots of land between the development. So it's an interesting time we're in.
Mm-hmm. Especially with, I just had Sylvia Bernstein on talking about aquaponics.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there's so many things that we can do, and the education is getting out there. And the bottom line, when you have these agrochemical companies saying that, oh, there's going to be a shortage of food and we need to push forward with GMOs in order to be able to accommodate that population, it is such a marketing scheme. It's propaganda that they're pushing in order to sell GMOs. And the bottom line is that people have food around them. We have so much food. It's just we don't recognize what is food. And unfortunately, because of the fact that we did change after World War II, I mean, we went through this phase where we stopped using the lawn for, or land rather, for mm-hmm. agricultural means, and we started getting more into ornamental land, if you will, where the front lawn was something that was not used for agriculture. It was basically a piece of land that was kept just for ornamental reasons and nothing more. And now there's a resurgence. I'm starting to see more and more people that are using their front property planting different types of gardens, whether it's an herb garden, rock garden, you know, all sorts of different things. They're trying to really change the landscape and make it more friendlier for pollinators, but also more productive as far as for culinary purposes, so on and so forth. So that's a very nice change to see. And I think a lot of that does have to do, as you pointed out, with the economy, because more and more people are being forced, because they don't have the money to go out, they're planting containers, they're planting in their own gardens at home, they're making gardens, they're participating in community gardens in some of the city areas so that they can not only participate and get back some of the vegetables, but, you know, contribute, and it does help communications within the community. So it's a really big plus side to this economy tanking for the last couple of years. So it's interesting how things happen, and I think the fact that all these things have come about at the perfect time, as you pointed out. Isn't there a movement that's going on with backyard chickens, Pat?
Oh, absolutely. There's an incredibly strong movement going on with backyard chickens. And, you know, what you were saying, June, how people are converting so much of their lawns to food production or to edible landscape. One of the interesting statistics that I really find fascinating is you probably know the answer to this, but what's the most irrigated, fertilized crop in America? The most irrigated and fertilized crop in America. And a lot of people will say corn or soybeans or cotton, and no, it's not marijuana either. but what it is we've got over about 30 to 40 million acres of lawn, fescue, grass. So that doesn't include horse farms, but it does include parks and, of course, in people's yards and backyards, front yards, green space. So Robert Rodale, just before he died, said that he felt, you know, Robert Rodale of Prevention Magazine and organic gardening, he felt that the farm of the future would be these hyperproductive chinks. You know, chinks is that little thing, mortar between the brick, these hyperproductive chinks of land between the subdivisions, between the development. And I think he's absolutely right. And that's why this Back to the Land movement is so strong. It's because we've got land that's already irrigated and fertilized or has access to that, and we can turn it into hyperproductive chinks of land to grow a lot of our food. And of course, the common statistic that goes around with the victory gardens of Eleanor Roosevelt in World War II is they produced 40% of all the produce that was consumed in America during those war years. And, of course, that was before the artificial and plant enhancement products really came into being. They generally came in right after World War II, after 1945. So there is a tremendous potential and possibility for food production locally, but we need a paradigm shift. We need a different view of how we produce our food and what really local food does mean to local economies.
You know, enter Occupy Backyard.
That's right, Occupy Backyard. Can I tell the story about Oprah Winfrey?
Please.
Yeah, I was doing a book tour in California. It was a 6-week book tour, and on the second day of the tour, I was in Santa Barbara and giving a presentation, an evening presentation at the Santa Barbara Public Library, beautiful building, really upscale. And I had Oprah Winfrey, Buff Orpington Hen, was on my arm, just sitting there, you know, as I was fiddling with the microphone, and I was up by the podium, and she decided to hop up on the podium. And, of course, there's about 150 people or so in the audience going, oh, my God, you know, the loose chicken, what are you going to do? And I knew she wouldn't go anywhere, so I finally got my microphone figured out. And she had then proceeded to the top of the podium, you know, and then she started going, brah, 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 brah. So I just put the microphone up there, and she he came over the loudspeakers talking. We finally figured out she was trying to speak to represent the 99% of all the chickens in the world who don't have a voice, and calling forth to occupy backyards where chickens can enable local agriculture. So that's the Occupy Backyards movement that's going on with chickens.
I've actually been honored by Tom Theobald, who has named one of his chicks, last year, who's really quite a pretty bird. She's got blondish feathers, and he calls her his June chicken. So now I officially, I must be doing something right. I have a chicken that's named after me.
There you go. That's right. That's great. Well,
and
I can name a chicken after you. I'm in one of the...
I just think it's great. Now, Pat, what is the first thing that people need to know about before they go out and start buying all this stuff? How do you know that raising hens is for you?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's something people all actually torment themselves over. And I think what they need to know is just don't be afraid of them. The chickens are easier to keep than dogs, and they're just such easy beings. They're such easy keepers, and they can be kept in such a relatively small space. And they'll literally work for chicken feed, which is not that much. There's a saying, June, that goes, first people get chickens, then they fall in love. And I've heard that from people over and over and over again, saying, oh, I wish I had done this decades ago. Why did I wait so long? You know, my husband drug his feet and finally convinced him, and now he can't stop watching and being with the chickens. So I would say just do it. And it doesn't take that much. They're very simple to keep. The equipment's not expensive. Coops are easy to build, and you can build very elegant ones and whimsical ones, but they don't have to cost, $300-$400 necessarily. So on the other hand, I know people that have chicken coops that are designer built and designed by architects, and they're thousands of dollars. So,
people tend to go a little overboard. It's like composting. I mean, I've seen so many people that have said to me, I just spent X amount of dollars on this really cool composter, and I look at them like, why? Why spend money on something that you could build yourself? I'm not a carpenter. I am not really handy when it comes to tools and stuff. That's why I usually call my brothers. When it comes to composting, I mean, it's not that complicated. It just requires a little bit of effort, like with anything else. And the same thing with chickens. I think the primary thing that people need to remember is you can't just get hens and then say, it's going to be like any other pet that you've adopted and just basically, you give it minimal attention. It doesn't work that way. It's a big commitment. And the thing is that you also have to think about how they are protected, especially at night when they're the most vulnerable, especially from predators.
Right, right. Yeah, it is a commitment. There's no question about that. And they do. The interesting thing, June, is we're about 3 to 4 generations away from any animal husbandry skills. Right after World War II, that was such a tipping point. Just about all the livestock disappeared from the urban areas where they were before. And so one of the things we're finding, and I think that's a lot of the resistance against chickens, is they just don't know what's involved and how to handle them and what care they need. So there's a lot of fear there. But that's one of the reasons, I mean, after you take one or two either read a few books on keeping and raising chickens, and there are plenty of them out there. But it's just not that hard. And what you say about protection, especially from predators, is really true, including human predators, we're finding out, can sometimes be a problem.
Well, it could be dogs. It could be cats. It doesn't matter what the location is, it could be raccoons. You have all sorts of predators that are lurking out there, and the bottom line is that do you have a setup that will protect these beings at night? I mean, whether you're an animal person or not, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is that it still is an expense to be considered. And if you don't have the right setup, and I'm not talking about just putting them in some little hole in the wall at night, you have to have some humane place where they can be comfortable, where they will be dry, and they'll be protected.
Right, and they like to be up off the ground. They like to roost on a perch up. One of the things that makes chickens so vulnerable, June, is they're night blind. They are totally night blind, so they cannot see anything after dark. And of course, the night predators, they're all out there stalking. So one of the best ways to keep your chickens safe from nighttime predators is just make sure that lock can't be fiddled with and opened by a raccoon, or they can't get in through a hole or dig underneath to get into the roost. So that's probably the primary, I think, consideration about keeping chickens is the nighttime predators. During the day, it tends to be dogs, you know, or foxes or coyotes. So mm-hmm. So in that sense, then my chickens, I've got two poultry protecting canines. I mean, they're out there kind of watching, and they've done a wonderful job protecting my flock. But sometimes you'll also need to have a perimeter fence or need to keep them contained, where it's not so much to keep the chickens in as to keep the predators out in many situations.
Now, Pat, where do you begin? I mean, do you get roosters? Do you need roosters? Or when it comes to purchasing the hens, how many do you need if you just want to start small?
Okay, well, to start with the rooster question, you do not need a rooster to get eggs from a hen. Many places, in fact, disallow roosters because of their crowing. Their crowing is about the same decibel level as a barking dog, but it's shrill, and it can go through the night, especially on full moons. So many places view roosters as causing noise pollution and have them banned or only with special permits. If you do have a rooster, the general rule of thumb is maybe anywhere from one rooster to about every 8 to 10 hens. It can be a range from 8 to 13. I do know of small flocks, micro flocks that might have three or four hens, and one rooster gets by and does quite nicely. The nice thing about roosters is they do have a job and they do serve a function, and that is they're predator alerts, and they will even be very gallant and sacrifice themselves before they'll let a fox or a coyote or just about anything get to their hens. So that's They protect the hens. They'll show them where food is. I mean, they'll sort of make sure they all get in at night. They do really serve a role.
I've been pecked by many roosters. I remember the first time that I encountered a leghorn. This thing was just it seemed like it was enormous, but I was a kid at the time, and it got me right in the forehead. Got my brother
Ooh.
Too. And
pecking?
Yeah. Oh. Jumped up and pecked us. And,
oh, wow, jumped up, yeah.
Petrified us.
Well,
but,
with good reason.
They are quite protective, and, you know, they're beautiful birds.
Well, they're beautiful, and they can be incredibly personable. Not all of them are aggressive, and it's kind of a fine line because, you know, they're part of their job is to protect the flock, and you want them to do that, and yet you don't want them to come after you or little kids or the family dog. So any rooster that tends to be aggressive towards me or my dogs or other people, I usually send them to freezer camp. I just don't want to I don't want to breed that much of aggressiveness in through the next lines. But then too, they can really hurt you. I mean, there's spurs, these little that can be dagger like that can pretty well slash. So I don't keep dangerous roosters around.
They do happen. I mean, they do occur, should I say, or can be found. I'm trying to find the right words.
Roosters happen.
Yeah.
They just happen.
About the memories. Yeah, it's, you know, they're beautiful and they do serve a purpose, as you said, but depends. It depends upon what you're looking to do. Some people could care less if they're woken up by a rooster. Personally, I think geese are more... more disturbing, but, you know, once again, geese the perfect alarm clocks and the perfect watchdog, so to speak. But, you know, roosters are, once again, not something that you necessarily need. I think I personally think that if people are going to start out, especially if they don't know what they're doing, they should, as you described, start off with the microflocks, because I think that that's a smarter approach, because then you can see what exactly is involved before you get too crazy. I mean, people tend to go nuts, and if you've got 100 baby chicks and you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, that can be quite intimidating. You're right.
Well, yeah, and plus the baby chicks will die, the majority of them, especially if you don't know how to care for them properly. And, you know, once again, if you're going to do something that you've never done before, doesn't matter how many books you've read, do it slowly.
Yeah. Start small and do it slowly. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think people ask me all the time, how many should I get? What's the ideal number of chicks? And I think I'm going to give a range, June, but I think the minimum number of hens or chickens should be about 3, because
yeah,
they're very social. They need company, and then that allows for attrition. If one of them gets picked off, or you know, there's always something that will love your chickens more than you, kind of thing with the predators. But then also, I think city codes, we're encouraging them to consider 6 to 12 chickens to be allowed within the cities, because then it allows for attrition to have replacement chicks as they come along, or replacement hens. And then also, if we're looking forward towards food self-sufficiency, if you've got at least, say, 2 hens for every person in the household, you'll have enough eggs, because by allowing for 2 in the household, the older ones will lay a little fewer eggs as they get older, and then the younger ones maybe haven't started laying eggs, because they don't begin laying until about 5 to 6 months old. So that's my recommended number, is anywhere from 6 to 12 for within city limits, and that's enough then also to possibly give to your neighbors or have some extra. So keep the flock small. I think Tractor Supply has a sales policy of only you have to buy at least 6 chicks, and I think that's a good thing.
What I think some people are also doing, especially if they are doing the microflock style or method, whatever you want to call it, size, I guess, they are going in with other people, and people that they find in whether it's an online community or even a local club, where they are, you know, talking to other people that are looking to do this and looking to learn at the same time. And it's a great way to also cut your expenses in half, especially if there are minimum requirements. And I know with beekeeping, a lot of the beekeeping clubs, they do that because you get a break on the shipping, or you might even get mm-hmm. free shipping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just something that kind of makes sense. Plus, it's always nice to have a buddy where you can call somebody and say, hey, you know, I don't know what I should do, this is what happened, so on and so forth. Or if you need a hand with something, or if you happen to be traveling and have to be out of town for a couple of days, you need somebody who knows what they're doing and can make sure everything is okay while you're away.
Yeah, right, absolutely. There's a comment in the chat room here, June. It's from Walter. He says he has some very tame roos. And that's a really good point, that not all roosters turn aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I've got one that I can just go up and pick up any time, and he'll pop his head on my shoulder, you know. he'll sit on my arm, but he's so heavy. He weighs about 10 pounds, so it's a little hard to kind of manage him the way I can hens. But
we had many roosters that were great. It's just the first introduction to roosters up on my parents' farm, that's basically what happened. And I always think back about that time, because we had 2 roosters that were white, and one was mean and the other one was really just gentle. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't tell the difference between the two of them, other than the fact that one wasn't really nice and the other one was. Yeah, I wasn't trying to say that all roosters are mean. They're not.
No. And the other thing that you pointed out earlier, too, June, is that roosters do happen. Even if you order from the hatcheries and you say you get what's all females, the chances are that the sexing isn't 100%, and eventually you'll get a rooster. And of course, that's then what do you do? I mean, that's something that always comes up in the discussions. And there are several things that several ways to manage roosters if they're illegal in the city. One of the things is that something we should talk about here.
Yeah, please. That's,
yeah, because
it's a good point.
Roosters again, it's the noise throughout the night. But one of the things you can do is, of course, they always find a home for them. There usually will be someone outside the city that will take a rooster for you. We have the Natural Bridge Zoo here in Rockbridge County, and they'll take any unwanted chicken, and they use it for big cat food for the lions and the tigers and that sort of thing. They put them down very humanely. So that's one, you know, passing along the life to go. Our Poultry and Garden Club, as we have several members, myself included, that any bird, anywhere, anytime, will come rescue or take care of if it's not wanted or find a home for it. And, of course, there's always the tailgate kind of solutions where you can go to one of these livestock solutions and see if someone will buy your rooster for you. And then finally, I know of about 5 homesteaders that would love to have any extra roosters. And yes, they'll process them, but you know, the rooster's life hasn't gone in vain, I guess you'd say. So those are some of the options. If you have roosters and darn can't keep them, they're almost always is someone that will help you out and find a home for it one way or another.
I personally would prefer that, you know, you try to find a home where it's not going to wind up as somebody's dinner or otherwise, but...
eventually that seems to be a rooster's fate, whether it's a predator, a human, or a bacteria and fungus. You know, we all end up being dinner for someone, something, some being somewhere, somehow. So it's just the cycle of life.
Now, with roosters and hens, what actually is the lifespan of a hen and of a rooster? If you had one of each and you fed them, you cared for them, and they just spent their life on your farm, how long would they live?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the oldest recorded hen is about 20 years old. They can live quite a long, long, happy life. I knew of a hen that was a little barred rock. She was 10 years old, and she would lay one egg every spring.
Wow.
And when she turned 10, in that 10th year, she decided that she wanted to sit on a nest, their clutch of eggs, and that she wanted to sit on them and hatch them out. And so her owners let her, and she did. She hatched them out. She brooded